who described Hirsch's repugnant campaign as asserted suppression. David Hirsch appealed to Goldsmith Student Union to investigate Sarah Baffo for anti-Semitism and was met with the disdain such disingenuous codswallop deserves. Ed Nejari, the chief executive of Goldsmith Student Union, dismissed the pathetic claims of Israeli regime asset Hirsch and defended Baffo's home truth as protected as free speech. This must all be rather disconcerting for Hirsch, who's grown used to having his own way. A student of his classes at Goldsmith has given Palestine declassified testimony on the basis of anonymity due to fears for their safety that Hirsch has invited into his class William Baldet, Prevent Strategy Coordinator, the British government's intelligence program targeting Muslim children. When hosting Baldet in his class, the fearful student attested that Hirsch referred to him as, quote, a very close family friend. How cozy.
David, this controversy was over criticisms that Hirsch has made over the decolonize the university. I mean, how does that relate to Palestine?
Well, the way in which the decolonization movement in universities has developed is a focus on the history of colonialism, of slavery, the role of many universities, including the university I used to work at, Bristol, in the slavery movement, in the sense that universities were built on the profits from slavery. But, of course, colonization hasn't stopped. The colony, settler colony in Palestine is over 70 years old now, and we face the same processes in relation to decolonization of Palestine as we do in relation to other sorts of issues. But the Zionists don't want us to think about it that way. They want us to think about this as being some kind of problem of terrorism or ethnic conflict or vying for different parts of the land. But no, this is a question of colonization. And it's not in any way anti-Semitic to refer to the occupation of Palestine as being settler colonialism, because it is. And so what we see here is the Zionists being uncomfortable with this more general idea of decolonialization because they fear that it will be applied quite rightly to Palestine.
Mm. Mick, if we can get Mick back up on the screen, I see that Hirsch has collaborated closely with Leslie Claff of Sheffield Hallam University, but is also part of the Zionist regime connected to the UK Lawyers for Israel. I mean, you've come across it recently, haven't you? Can tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, but if I tell you, Chris, you may not believe me, because I also sat through a disciplinary tribunal by the General Teaching Council of Scotland, and it was for one of her people who was caught fabricating an identity on Facebook, fabricating a crime, which Mr. Edward Sutherland, the accused, then attributed to Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. I mean, he was caught, he had no defence. However, the defence, he was charged by the GTCS with posting anti-Semitic material. You know, after identifying his fellow conspirator, Matthew Berlow, as a Zionist, he said, the Zionist big nose will be out of joint. I mean, clearly he was posting anti-Semitic rubbish in order to trap some unwary, you know, naive or foolish person who was emoting over Palestine and trap them and then be able to say, look how polluted the Palestine Solidarity Movement is. By the way, nobody responded to his anti-Semitic stuff. However, Claff then appears for lawyers, UK Lawyers for Israel, in the tribunal, and she hammers away incessantly that his Zionism should not be confused with anti-Semitism, that her buddy was just masquerading as an anti-Zionist. And anybody who thinks that anti-Zionism is connected to anti-Semitism, that talking about, you know, that bringing the two together, anybody who thinks that's a fool. So she was adamant, and so were the other Friends of Israel witnesses. There were four of them in total who absolutely insisted that anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism were two distinct and separate things. Now, she may change her song the following week when she's trying to smear one of us. But that I've got it on record, very detailed record. That's what she said. That's how UK Lawyers for Israel prove they don't want to protect Jews from anti-Semitism. I mean, if you go around talking about Jewish big noses or Zionist big noses when it's quite clear you're talking about a Jewish lawyer, that's anti-Semitism. There is some of it. I mean, most of us are smeared for fake anti-Semitism, but there is some anti-Semitism. Here's this guy posting this stuff on the internet, and he's defended by UK lawyers for Israel who make the case that actually you and I would agree with the words of it, but certainly not the dishonesty of it.
Incredible. David, what's the relevance, though, if I come to you, about William Baldock being brought into Hirsch's class? I mean, he's works closely, with the Islamophobic Prevent apparatus, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's a Prevent coordinator, and he's taken significant sums of money from the Home Office's Prevent programme. And as the film sort of indicated there, the Prevent programme is run by the Homeland Security Group of the Home Office, which is a British intelligence agency. And so anyone who's associated with it, in the sense of taking money from it or acting on its behalf, is effectively an asset of British intelligence. Now, the Prevent programme, as everyone knows, targets Muslims, is Islamophobic, overwhelmingly focuses on Islam and Muslims as being the problem in relation to questions of radicalisation. And to bring someone like that into your class is a direct threat to anybody in the class who is Muslim, or even a person who might appear to be Muslim because of the colour of their skin or their ethnic origin. So, I mean, that's a sort of way of attacking students, really, to bring people like that into the class. And the indication that this is a close family friend, well, I mean, that shows something really quite worrying about the way in which this whole process operates. There is no pushback against this kind of activity in classes, whereas even to mention Zionism in class, as I did, it does cause trouble. So we see the double standards that are there in higher education.
Absolutely. I mean, Mick, what do you think about the way in which students at UCU responded to the attempted smears in defence of Hirsch? I mean, are the lessons, you think, to be learnt there?
It's beautiful. It's a thing of joy to see people fight back against this smear. When you compare the confidence and the determination and the contempt that Hirsch deserves being meted out, it's just a real pleasure, because so many people in the upper levels of university management, I mean, Corbyn in the Labour Party, but many others, the SNP, Scottish government, have just shown how craven they are. I don't know if they believe the IHRA is worth anything, but they rushed to adopt it. You know, the College of Bishops of the Church of England rushed to adopt it at the same time that Jeremy Corbyn was under vicious attack. So to see a fight back, to see people who understand that up is up and down is down, and anti-racism is what it is. It doesn't need a 500-word definition to tell you what it is. And to be smeared by people who support a state of state-enforced racism, apartheid, which kills Palestinians because they are Palestinians, which is guilty of full-spectrum criminality. And to see the assets, in the general sense they're useful to, the assets of that state come out and attack lifelong anti-racists is horrific. But now they fight back. And that's just a joy. I mean, up here, after Boris Johnson's brother, that was the university's minister, he sent out a letter to every university saying, beware of Israeli Apartheid Week. Be very careful. It's very nasty. And in Dundee University, we had a branch, and the university was having a speaker, Jackie Walker, who ironically was going to speak about free speech on the issue of Palestine. The university management insisted her speech be produced 2 weeks in advance, that somebody from management would sit in the classroom with the right to intervene at any moment if he thought she was saying something disagreeable. Now, the students, I discussed with them beforehand, wrote a letter to the university saying, we're having the meeting. If you cancel the room, we're having it on the steps outside. We're going to appeal to the world for the enemies of free speech. So what I'm trying to say is, anybody who fights back like these students at UCU, it's a joy. And you know something? If you fight back, you usually win. Yeah?
Absolutely. Well, Mick, I mean, you're a great role model for fighting back, and you've proved that with your two successful court cases in the Scottish court. So thank you for your contribution today. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because, unfortunately, we're out of time again. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio today our speaker, Sister Razia Batul Najafi. She's an Islamic researcher, and I have had this pleasure to sit with her in the studio today. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you so
much
for coming.
Can I ask you, how are you?
Alhamdulillah.
I know you're looking perfect, mashallah.
Thank you so much. I am looking perfect because you're in front of me.
Alhamdulillah.
Today, I would want to start with an audience question, which is, what is the best age to make a child sleep in another room who has been sleeping in between his parents since his birth? And in case a child is growing up and is not ready to sleep in a separate room, is there any tip or idea to make him feel he should sleep in another room? Well, that's a very challenging question.
Yeah. As we have discussed before too, in chapter Nur, Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala is mentioning about the age of maybe approximately after 6-7. We call it mumayyiz. Mumayyiz in Islamic term means the child who now has this recognition of male and female a bit, like in a very, very
who's
child.
Who's able to differentiate between good and bad.
Yeah, good and bad. Yeah. And a bit he or she knows that, yeah, this is boy, this is girl. And, you know, girls and boys, they are different. So look at, the sensitivity of Islam. I love it. The qawaneen, the ahkam, rules, and the rulings for mumayyiz. Mumayyiz from tamiz.
All right.
Yeah, tamiz. Means the one who can differentiate. Yeah, differentiate between, you know, male and females, a bit needs, and, you know, the differences between them, very little, but still, look at the still Islam is sensitive, still, you know. So we need so much emphasis to talk about this most, you know, sensitive topic, according to Quranic teaching. Because yes, Quran is sensitive, we have to be sensitive too.
Exactly.
So, yeah, therefore, after six, after seven-ish, six-ish, you know, we have to be very careful about our dressing. You know, you can't believe it in Islam. In me, for example, if I'm having a guest, for example, yeah? And, for example, your child, your son is somehow?
Some 6 years old.
Six, yeah. So your son sun is coming, so I cannot wear the very comfortable dress. Yeah, right. The way I dress up in front of ladies. I have to keep eye on Mumayya's child. I say, Zainab's son is here. Right. He is plus six. So I have to wear something modest. Not complete hijab, but something modest.
At least modest,
covering my head, you know, having full sleeve. So this kind of teaching Islam is, teaching
us. Providing us. Yeah. So you're trying to say, if a child is visiting your home who is 6 plus, or even if you have a child at home who is around 6 or 7, you need to take care of your dressing. You need to be a little modest. If not, you're not doing a very proper Islamic hijab, but at least you need to have a modest dressing so that you cannot be like a center of attraction for that child.
Absolutely.
Sister, I'll be talking to you. We need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the question that audiences have made. First of all, before you answer this question, I would want to ask you, is there any concept like you need to definitely make your child sleep with you since he's born?
Yeah, Islamically, I think after 2 years, because within that 2 years, you have to give...
You have to feed your child. Yeah. Right.
So because of breastfeeding, Islam is not that much emphasizing to make him or her
about
sleep.
Your own personal life.
Yeah. So you can have something, you know, some cot nearby your bed. Yeah.
All right.
It's not necessary that the
child... You put your child in between.
Exactly.
All right.
So the child would be in the same room, but, you know,
maybe in some separate bed.
Yeah, separate bed. So that would be the best thing. And then after 6-7, we recommend, according to Islamic teaching, so it would be more recommended to separate the bed and definitely the room.
Oh,
yeah. So, and even we have a hadith and sayings of Masumin alayhi salam that... You know, the brothers and sisters, they're not allowed to share the same quilt and same, we can say blankets.
All right.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, they're just little. Like maybe they're just, you know, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old and they're having one quilt and they're sleeping together. So it's better to have a separate quilt. Maybe two small children, they are sleeping in one big double bed. They can sleep, but they should have their own quilts or whatever.
Separate
blankets.
Covering.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, separate blankets.
So even if they are siblings, you need to separate them. They cannot sleep in one blanket.
Even siblings, you know, brother, sisters, you know, look the sensitivity, you know.
Especially in the environment we are living in.
Yeah, this is Islam. And one more hadith says, like, if a young girl, for example, maybe again 6-7 years old girl, if she comes and sit on the lap of non-mahram, any like cousin or uncle who's not mahram,
not a mahram uncle, all right,
so it's not allowed to make her sit on non-mahram's lap,
all right,
or to kiss her cheeks. So these kind of small, very in detail, we have sayings of Masumin alayhi salam, which shows that
sensitivity, beautiful
education which Islam is teaching us.
All right.
And that means a lot, because nowadays we can observe, because now, especially nowadays, we understand more the value of these amazing teachings of Islam.
Yes, undoubtedly. So the beautiful point you said over here was that it's not mandatory to make your baby sleep in between you and your partner. Yes, a mother has to feed her baby, obviously, but she can separate the bedding though in the same room, so that she can also breastfeed the child and also like not to let the child sleep in between her and her partner. Sister, I'll be talking to you on that note, but here we need to take a very, very short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The 24th surah of the Holy Quran, Surah An-Nur, the first part of verse 58. O you who have faith, let your permission be sought by your slaves and those of you who have not reached puberty three times, before the dawn prayer, and when you put off your garments at noon, and after the night prayer.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Sister, we discussed a lot of points and you answered so many beautiful questions by audiences. Now, you also said what is the age, like when a child needs to be separated from the parents' room. There's one more challenging question we had. The question was that if a child is now 6 or 7 years, what you called as mumayyiz, the one who is able to differentiate between the good and bad, and who is able to differentiate between male and female, who is able to differentiate between different sexes, how do we separate that child from our room who is not kind of, who is not, you know, getting ready to get separated?
I think step by step, because after maybe 5 years, 6 years, it, you know, the in one jump, maybe your child cannot accept this big change, yeah, in big jump. So what I have seen in my friends' circle, that sometimes they say every, for example, Monday and Thursday, twice a week, you're allowed to sleep just for 1 hour with us. Then Mama Baba will take you to your room. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Or maybe once in a week, you can sleep with us. You know, that would be like a treat. And, or maybe before, when he used to or she used to sleep with us, we would not maybe pay attention that much towards him or her. But now you say, if you sleep in your bed, you know, we promise that we are going to give you this gift. For example, we'll keep something under your pillow
and
after
then
you sleep.
Fulfill your promises. Definitely.
Yeah. Small things, like whatever he likes, you know,
right.
Like maybe, I don't know, whatever is healthy,
so
something to eat.
So you have to encourage your
yeah.
child by different tips.
Yeah. And like telling them story, nice stories before going to bed more, mm-hmm. you know. So I think that steps will help, because I also have 8 years old child. So alhamdulillah, we are successful to make him
throw him out of
sleep.
The room.
No doubt. But just like that, you know, like, wow, you're my hero. Look at my Hussein. And definitely we bought a new quilt and, you know, set off his
bed. Brain bedding. Yeah.
So maybe somehow after 2-3 years, you know, we have to make refresh their bedroom and a big, huge teddy bear,
yeah.
according to his request. So he sleeps with his teddy bear, and definitely he has his brothers too in his room. And then, yeah, he's okay. But it was difficult, definitely, at first when we started to work this.
Well, they say that if there are no pains, there are no gains. So,
yeah.
So you have to make some expenditure. All right. Thank you, sister, for being with us. It was a really nice session with you. Thank you for answering so beautifully from the narrations from the Noble Quran. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. For any suggestions, for any questions, for any feedback, please email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. Our website is parstoday.com, wherein you can find all our programs. Going to the option Call of Islam and you'll find our programs. Until another episode, fi amanullah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam? Islam says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way. It's a complete way.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the lessons that we want to learn from Imam Ridha is to take advantage of the opportunity and the window that you're presented to spread the teachings of true Islam. It's not always that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala opens this window. But our ahadith say this, that there are times in your lives where divine breezes blow. There are windows of opportunity that Allah opens up. When the hadith says, make yourself available to those breezes. Right now, Allah has given us a chance to go over and explain Islam's teachings as is to the masses. Let's learn from Imam Ridha. Now, remember, the time of Imam, because he was our Imam for 20 years, and he began his imamate in the time of Harun al-Rashid. Harun al-Rashid, brothers and sisters, was one of the most savage of the Tawaghit. Of all of the Abbasid rulers, one of the most savage, one of the most muqtadir, one of those who was a law and order Tawaghut, was Harun al-Rashid. The beautiful thing about Imam al-Ridha was that he never hid his imamate. He was open about it. From the beginning, from the time of Harun al-Rashid, people used to warn Imam. Tell him, don't, blood is still dripping from the sword of Harun. How do you do this? Taqiyya. Don't use this opportunity to spread Islam as is. Harun, this is Harun we're talking about. You know what Imam Ridha did? He said this. He said that I take inspiration from that hadith of the Prophet. He said, the Prophet said, if Abu Jahl can take one hair off my head, then I'm not a prophet. He said, if Harun al-Rashid can take one hair off my head, I'm not an imam. What happened was, he recognized weakness. He saw fear in the eyes of the Tawhut. He recognized weakness. Some people couldn't see this. What happened was, and this is a long story, but I want to just summarize it. Harun al-Rashid had made such a blunder by first imprisoning his father. Right? For 4 years, the last 4 years of the life of Imam al-Kadhim, he was in prison. Before that, oppression, repression. But when he finally said, that's it, I have to murder him, and he finally murdered the imam, he paid such a political price, he couldn't touch Imam Ridha. Not that he didn't want to, not that he wasn't wicked, but for you and I, remember the story of Karbala? After Karbala, Yazid had made such a blunder by killing Imam Hussein, he paid such a political price that afterward, Yazid had to send the family of the Prophet back with respect to talk about how bad Umar bin Sa'd was. Right? These are wicked people. But the situation was such you couldn't touch him. And the imam used that to his advantage. He never hid his imamate. He was open about who he was, what he was doing, what he was. So remember we talked before about the secret organization of the Shia? That the Shia were moving and they had the secret organization, and it was there from the time of Imam Ali. The people who were the true Shia were the people who were aligned with the Imam, ready to sacrifice for the Imam, moving monies around to make sure that activities were happening, the orders of the Imam were being carried out in various areas. Those were the Shia. This secret organization reached the height of its activity in the time of Imam al-Ridha. And the Imam was moving. During the time of Harun al-Rashid, he couldn't touch him. After him, there was a civil war in the Abbasid caliphate. The war was between Amin, one of the sons of Harun, and Ma'mun. It lasted 5 years. During those 5 years, our imam pursued the direction that the Ahlul Bayt had always pursued. You explain the religion so that it matures in the minds of the people. You make sure that they've understood this revolutionary ideology. You take away the distortions that are there that are keeping people, the way that they would like to introduce Islam will be an Islam that will put people to sleep. So he was over there doing that and also readying that group of people who'd be willing to sacrifice so that he could carry out that mission. What happened now is once he was able to establish himself, Ma'mun, now he figured it was time to deal with the real threat, Imam Ridha. What did he do? And again, he had several goals in doing this because of his own situation, how tough it was for him as someone who was half Arab, half Irani, who didn't have the support of the Abbasids, with uprisings happens on the Alawis in his kingdom. The lack of popularity, the jealousy amongst the ruling classes, there was so much going on. He decided the best solution is to go over and make Imam Ridha the crown prince. I mean, what kind of a crown prince, though? Imam Ridha's older than he is. He announces himself as his successor. But he said, no, I'll go over. But what happened was, it was, remember, this is an imam who is open about his imamate. His father, Imam Musa, had been open about his imamate. You remember the story from the life of Imam Kadha, meaning his father had introduced himself. People knew who they were dealing with. The story is this. One of the many stories. Our imam, Imam Kadha, Harun, is someone who's trying to present himself as part of the family of the Prophet, as a good person. Someone, he would do publicity stunts. He would show off that relationship that he had with the Prophet, the leader of the Mu'mineen. He said, I want to, as a family member of the Prophet's family, I want to return Fadak to you, Ahlul Bayt. People will cheer and they will clap and they will see that I'm such a great person. The imam said, no, you don't want to give Fadak back to me. He said, no, I insist. He said, no. He said, no. He said, I insist. He said, look, if I ask for it back, I want the original border of Fadak. He said, the original border of Fadak. The imam said, okay. He said, one of the borders of Fadak is the end of the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen. And they said, as soon as he started saying the borders of Fadak, the face of Harun starts changing. He said, one of the borders is Africa, Tunisia. One of the borders is Uzbekistan. By the time he finished, it was the whole kingdom, the Islamic kingdom. Harun was like, well, you take the seat then. There's nothing left for us. So his father, Imam Kadhim, had explained what an imam was. It wasn't that this is a spiritual... No, I rule the Islamic kingdom. He knew, they knew who he was. He had always been calling for his imamate. Even his second in command, the man who ran his affairs for Ma'mun, he couldn't get, why would you say this person who says he's an imam with that meaning that this is your successor? Ma'mun pressed. And what happened was, the imam resisted so long and kept telling him no and playing the long game, to the extent that he started threatening him. And those who were carrying the messages back and forth, they would share them. Like, didn't make sense. This guy is being offered to be the crown prince. I mean, if I was offered to be the crown prince, that would be it. I mean, and he's refusing again and again. The message got out. It became clear that you won't take no for an answer. But not that the imam wants this. The imam finally, even once he brought him to Marv, the capital at that time, the negotiations continued. He started threatening the imam. The imam said, okay, I'll accept if I don't have anything to do with the government. He refused to support the deep state. I'm not going to sign anything. I'm not going to prove anything. I'm just sitting there. Everybody knows I don't want this. He had already told people, you Ma'mun, you're going to kill me. He told them, pray over me when I leave. Right? So the hope that Ma'mun had that I'm going to get popularity and people will think... The thing that happened though, Imam Ma'mun was now at the end of his rope. He accepted. What happened was that now that he was a government official, Imam Ridha did something we had never been able to do. For 150 years, we were calling to imamate in secret, meaning you, as one of the Shia who are connected to the imam, you're meeting your neighbors, you're meeting your friends. If you see readiness, you see that this person is willing to listen, you take them aside, you say, by the way, there's an imam is this person, they rule. And the person, if you saw that readiness, you would invite them. Now, Imam Ridha took it to a whole nother level. Now, openly, he's calling for his, because he's a government official, I'm the crown prince. We had never gotten to this stage. He saw that window of opportunity, the chance to explain true Islam, true Tawheed.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. شكور ودود قيوم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing India in a changing global geostrategic environment in a conversation with author and former ambassador M.K. Bhadrakumar. But first, this brief analysis.
In the wake of the Western sanctions on Russia, pressure was applied on India to join these sanctions, which India, like most other non-Western nations, refused to join. India insisted on maintaining its decades-old strategic relation with Russia and the former Soviet Union as it relates to energy and food imports, but particularly as it relates to India's military, which has traditionally used a large percentage of Russian-made hardware and technology. This refusal resulted in the West sending UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson to India in order to offer military hardware contracts as an alternative to the Russian strategic relation. In general, the US and the West are pursuing a strategy of using India as a wedge against Asian and Eurasian integration by stoking tensions between India and China and India and Pakistan. Given its size and power, India insists on its strategic independence, and while, for example, it is a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it is also a member of the US-led Quad Group, along with Japan and Australia. As the US keeps raising tensions and stoking conflicts, it's questionable whether it's possible for countries such as India to maintain such a balance between the West and the rest without having to, at some point, choose a side. Like all countries, India too is faced with a rapidly changing geostrategic environment. Since the 19th century, the West's strategy in Eurasia has been to cause conflict and destabilization in order to prevent Asian nations from becoming global powers and in order to prevent a strategic alignment between Asian nations against Western imperialism and neo-imperialism. In this environment, the US and its vassals will use every dirty trick to cause conflict between India and its Asian neighbors, and will use every dirty trick to destabilize India domestically in pursuit of the West's goal of strategic domination of Eurasia. This is the challenge facing Indian elites, as they have to resolve India's strategic challenges, particularly its relationship with China and its significant domestic socio-economic underdevelopment, so that India does not become a second Ukraine sacrificed by the United States and the West in its strategic conflict with China, Russia, and other rising Asian powers. It seems that India has enough elites who are familiar with the real character of Western nations and who have not forgotten the injustices perpetrated upon the Indian people by Western imperialism. On the other hand, there are also those elites in India who are desperately seeking to maintain their good standing with Western security and financial elites, and their personal and family contacts and residencies in Western capitals and cities, who would be willing to offer India as a platform for Western strategic infiltration into Asia. Undoubtedly, India will be a global superpower in the future if it is capable of resolving its domestic and international challenges without succumbing to the temptation of becoming a pawn of the West in return for money and privileges offered by the Western oligarchy to Indian elites, similar to what we have witnessed in countries smaller and less powerful than India, and which ultimately led to the ruin and bankruptcy of those countries.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you so much for joining us on Insight. You know, when we started the program, it's a new show. It's a new program that we started. One of the first topics that we decided that we're going to do was India, because of India's importance in terms of the geostrategic situation that exists in the world, and being one of the largest countries and one of the most populous countries, and all the reasons that everybody knows as to the importance of India. And of course, the first person we thought of doing the interview with and the conversation with was you, because people can follow you on indiapunchline.com, and you're also a columnist for The Cradle, where you have very interesting articles. I always benefit from reading your articles. They're insightful, and they're also very entertaining as well, which is a rare combination. So I really recommend to go check out your writings on these platforms that I mentioned. So with that, Mr. Ambassador, I want to get straight into it. In terms of India, it's very interesting because we see that there is a strategic realignment happening in the world. Of course, all of this accelerated by the war in Ukraine. It's very interesting. Zbigniew Brzezinski, before he passed away and before he, when he wrote in his last book, he said the worst case scenario for the United States is an alignment between China, Russia, and Iran. And interestingly, he didn't mention India really in this issue, which you know, I think has its reasons why he didn't mention this. So we have this strategic realignment, and we see that immediately the West begins to work on India to prevent India from entering into this larger Eurasian integration. Maybe they are not capable of completely preventing it, but they want to hedge their bets with India, having a large, powerful country in Asia, which is able to be used as a wedge, as a balance, whatever word you want to use, whatever concept you want to use, in this emerging Eurasian geostrategic alignment, which, as a person like Zbigniew Brzezinski, which is considered one of the leading geostrategists of the West, called the worst-case scenario for the West. So we saw recently that in the Ukraine war, there was a lot of pressure for India to join the sanctions, and very clearly India rejected that. Both the foreign minister and things that were stated by the Indians in terms of their long history with Russia, even going back to the time of the Soviet Union, in terms of the military relations that they have and the military in India. And then what happened, very interestingly, is that immediately you see Boris Johnson, you know, flying into India, talking about, you know, long-term strategic contracts in terms of the military and weaning the Indians away from their dependence on Russia. We have the European Union talking about these things. The thing that I find interesting, or the thing that maybe we should talk about, is this. I believe that India sees itself as powerful enough in order to be able to balance these events. That on the one hand, it is in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, but it is also in the Quad. On the one hand, it has these strong relations with Russia, but on the other hand, it has these strong relations with the West, whether it's the U.S. or England. You know, in a lot of West Asia, there's a funny expression. They say somebody trying to dance at two weddings at the same time. It seems that India feels that it is powerful and important enough to be able to do this straddle, this bridge, this gap. And from some of the writings that I read, that you've written from some of your writings, it seems to me that you believe that maybe this is not something that can be straddled and can be achieved in the long run for India. That at some point India has to make a choice, whether it is with the West or the rest, as you called it. You talked about India having a lot of straw men in one of your articles, about there being an elite in India that is very much, you know, susceptible to corruption, maybe, from certain forces, whether it's the West coming in and trying to, you know, as we've seen in many countries, this is not specific to India, but a lot of countries, you see elites desiring to be part of this Western elite, and so in that way, the West comes in and does certain things. So with all this, big biryani rice that I just gave you in terms of everything being mixed together. Can you please give us some insight into this? What's going to happen with India and in the strategic realignment that's happening in the world today?
You see, well, I broadly agree with your reading of the situation. I would only qualify this way, right at the beginning, that there are different templates here from the Indian perspective that cannot be overlooked. You know, the alignment, the Eurasian alignment is an esoteric concept. But what I am mentioning are very tangible, practical level, which are of very important concern for India. First is in the present situation, if you dissect the present situation, you're right, India has come under immense pressure from the Western world. But there are why India is taking a position like this is not so much as a desire to balance, but in terms of asserting its strategic autonomy. And that autonomy is important for India from two, three different angles. First and foremost, there is this aspect of India's national policies. Now, national policies are, as in most countries in the developing world, they are in regard of development, economic growth development, and they need to be sustained. And during this period of the pandemic, they have taken a heavy beating, you know, these policies and these there's been a serious setback. Our central bank, called the Reserve Bank of India, only last week came out with an assessment that it will be not before 2034, 2035, that India will be able to recover from the damages caused by the pandemic. So you can imagine there is a criticality about this period of time ahead. The next 10 to 15 year period, the corridor of time. Much as we are all glued to the Ukraine crisis, I'm only underscoring that India has its own concerns and its own national priorities. And I, for one, will firmly endorse the view that a good foreign policy is a reflection of the national policy. That is point number one. Therefore, you know, whatever stance we are adopting are primarily in a defensive way, in the sense that we don't want to get damaged collaterally or otherwise. You know the famous African proverb saying that when elephants clash, it is the grass on the ground that suffers. So, you know, this kind of thing can happen, and India is a is aspiring to be a globalized power, and what happens in other parts of the world are certainly going to impact Indian interests. This is the first one. The second template, which is equally important, in a way from the strategic perspective, the most important consideration is that Russia is not like any other power for India. Russia has been an anchor sheet for Indian strategies for close to some 60, 70 years, which is for a country with 75 years of independence. Right. Is a long, long period of time, almost from its childhood.
Exactly.
So you see, through the entire period of adulthood, India has viewed Russia in a certain way. India has experienced the understanding and support that Russia has shown toward India. And whoever may say anything else, you know, we are not in the habit of dumping our friends. Exactly. We are not in the habit of switching sides. India never did that, you know. You look at the whole history of Indian diplomacy. It has been, there is always a consistency. Once a situation arises and the country takes a principled stance, it has derived the principles behind it. And it is clear-headed about it. And it pursues that. Of course, there would be ups and downs, and there are certain periods of time when India cannot be optimal because of its own, limitations in a situation. But broadly, the compass is set. That is the second point. And here, the tangible factors are, this is a very important relationship even today for India. One is estimations vary, but some people say even up to 60%, 70% of the weaponry, for example, used in the Indian Armed Forces are of Russian origin. And it's an important contributor to India's defense capability. And it's not only that in quantitative terms, it is also in qualitative terms. Mm-hmm. It's a well-known thing that the Western world, much as we can diversify our sourcing of weaponry, mm-hmm. and many Western countries, and there are no embargo against India. But, Western countries, and particularly the Americans, are almost always reluctant about parting with really modern advanced technology transfer. Yes. They want to just sell, and they want to keep the software in their hands,
exactly.
because it is also geopolitically important that India does things the way they want in any given situation involving military or coercive use of power. The fact is, it is only Russia which is almost always given almost anything that India asks for in terms of very advanced cutting-edge military technology that it is readily given. And India has an old program which is struggling to take off, that is about building up a defense industry. Mm-hmm. It will be very, very incredible it may sound to you, but our defense industry is not as good as yours, for example, in Iran's. We would like to go
on. You should have been sanctioned. That would have helped, I think. If
we would actually go on the same track. You've done fantastically well in building up an indigenous capability. India wants to go on that track.
Yes.
And it is only Russia which has been helping us in terms of co-production, designing, and all kinds of work like this. Otherwise, the others, they just want us to buy off the shelf. And they make good money on it, and then they just go in a different direction. So all these considerations are there. Then in political terms also, it's a veto-holding power in the United Nations. Exactly. And I cannot recollect a single instance where an Indian national interest is involved. Russia has not helped India.
Exactly.
Whatever might be its reservations, even then it has been forthcoming with support for India. I'm not speaking just about Kashmir. The kind of level of understanding is, it's all pervasive. So you see, this is the second template. And, the third template is, that initially there is a certain kind of labeling that this thing unfolding in Ukraine mm-hmm. is about democracy versus autocracy. But, we have a very competent foreign policy establishment. And they could see through it and understand what is the ultimate Western objective, which is to weaken and, if possible, destroy in Russia. Now, it's unthinkable that India can be party to such a conspiracy.
Right.
We understand well, of course, there is a lot of damage taking place to Ukraine. The people there are undergoing a lot of suffering. And the war must end. There must be a ceasefire. There must be a peaceful resolution. All that said, we do not ignore the fact that geopolitics is at work there. And India cannot take a partisan view of it. So this is what you have said is in terms of the overarching essence of it, which is about Eurasian integration, about multipolarity. And so on. But these underlying templates are also affecting the Indian attitudes profoundly at this point in time.
Okay, Mr. Ambassador, I think you mentioned some very interesting things. First of all, I think you pointed to an issue which is good that we don't forget, which is that during the crisis, during the epidemic, the coronavirus and the COVID crisis, a lot of countries came to see who their real friends are. and who it is that will really help them. And unfortunately for India, we really saw that the West was not really that helpful in many ways. And so this is one interesting point, and I think that may be a factor in the thinking that is now happening maybe in India in terms of who can they really trust. And of course, you mentioned the very long and important strategic connection that India has had with Russia, so this is very important. You mentioned strategic autonomy, which I think is a key concept, because most countries want to have that, actually. Most countries would prefer to be able to make their own choices in terms of where they want to go. And I think that's maybe a good way of understanding why India is doing the things that it is doing, as opposed to maybe the West, because they are used to using and instrumentalizing other countries.